Hello, and welcome to the Immigration Policy Center Conference on State Legislation. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions. You can enter the question queue at any time during the conference by pressing star 1 on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ms. Michelle Waslin. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mark. Good afternoon, everyone. I am Michelle Waslin. I'm the Senior Policy Analyst at the Immigration Policy Center. IPC is the policy wing of the American Immigration Council here in Washington, D.C. IPC is a nonpartisan organization that provides policymakers, the media, and the general public with accurate information about the role of immigrants and immigration policy on U.S. society. So I want to start out by thanking all of you for joining us on today's call on this issue of state immigration legislation. As we all know, this is a hot topic, and many of the state legislatures are now going into session, and we know that immigration is going to be one of the hotly contested issues in many states around the country. So we have a team of great speakers today who are going to present you with a lot of information and different aspects of this state immigration legislation issue. So our speakers today will be John Blaser. John is the policy attorney at the National Immigration Law Center. Then we have Vivek Malhotra, who is advocacy and policy counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU. Then I am going to speak. And then Suman Raghunathan is the immigration policy specialist at Progressive States Network. So each speaker will now give you a short presentation, and then after everybody's spoken, we will open up the lines for questions. I also just want to remind everybody that IPC has materials available at our website, which is immigrationpolicy.org, and you can click on key issue areas on the right, and then there's a whole resource page called Responding to State Immigration Legislation. And the other speakers should feel free to give information about their organizations and their websites as well. Just a final reminder, this call is being recorded for public use, and we will also post it on IPC's website later when the call is finished. So, John, go ahead and get us started.
Thank you, Michelle, and thank you to everyone joining today's call. As state legislators gear up for work in 2011, it's clear that we are going to continue to see high levels of state activity and policies affecting immigrants and immigration. And one of the most important driving factors in this is the apparent collapse of comprehensive immigration reform at the federal level. This loss of faith has been growing for years, but there now is extreme doubt in all quarters as to whether Congress has the ability or the will in the short term to enact structural reforms to our federal immigration system. And this is unfortunate because even in a place like Arizona, which has been a place where extremism has often prevailed on these issues, strong majorities of the public support allowing unauthorized immigrants living here now to remain in the country if they have a job and no criminal record. And nearly three-fourths of the public, even in Arizona, support changes to the law enabling workers from abroad to secure jobs legally when those workers are needed for the economy. This is core elements of comprehensive immigration reforms for which there is very strong support, but no one has faith that Congress will enact these reforms anytime soon. So we're seeing states really filling the gap of congressional inaction. The policies that have gotten the most attention in the media, because they're the sources of controversy, are those that seek to exclude, marginalize, and punish unauthorized immigrants by pushing them out of states, deterring them from coming into states, and making life miserable for those who remain, regardless of their contributions to the economy and their local communities. In the past years, states will, states will continue to consider restrictive legislation in areas such as driver's licenses and identification, employment verification, and law enforcement. And we do expect to see enactment of Arizona 1070 copycats in some states, perhaps first in South Carolina. The fact that a court has enjoined core provisions of that bill from being implemented in Arizona has given pause to some states, but other states seem to welcome the confrontation and with it the legal costs and harms to the economy and tax base. When it comes to immigrant bashing, it seems that fiscal conservatism seems to fly out the window for some legislators, a point that Michelle Waslin will amplify later on today's call. In addition, An extremist band of state legislatures have expressed their intent to push the envelope even further, moving beyond attacks on illegal immigration and going after citizen babies by attacking one of the most cherished principles enshrined in the United States Constitution, the 14th Amendment. And Vivek Malhotra will address this issue in greater detail. This effort started with a bang a couple weeks ago, but there are signs that it may be fizzling out a bit because of unease in the Republican Party, with mainstream Republicans really starting to ask the question of whether the party may be overreaching at the risk of permanently alienating the fastest-growing demographic base in American politics, Latinos, as well as losing touch with the broader populace, which wants more than anything solutions to the jobs and the economy, which restrictionist immigration policymaking has done nothing to address or improve, and there are some signs that it's made matters worse in some places. On the other hand, and quite the opposite, there is a long-standing trend that continues of pro-immigrant, inclusive policymaking from states that view immigrants as assets to their economy and communities and a key ingredient of prosperity for all people. This trend, you know, which has taken hold in some places for decades, has gotten less attention by some press because it's in some places less controversial and more practical problem-solving oriented. But the yearning for positive solutions to these problems that bring communities together rather than dividing them has also amplified in the wake of federal inaction. And there's an important story to tell there, too. And in a moment, Suman Raghunathan will share some of the details of what's happening now in that area as well.
Great. Thank you very much, John. And now we have Vivek Malhotra.
Hi, everyone. I'm Vivek Malhotra, Advocacy and Policy Counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. We have, obviously, a national office in New York, but we are comprised of 53 state affiliate offices all across the country, and certainly our affiliates have been very involved in analyzing some of the legislation that's been introduced and joining with a number of other partners in their states to advocate against anti-immigrant legislation, but also promote the civil liberties and civil rights of immigrants across the country through litigation, advocacy, and public education. With that, I think I'll just pick up the thread here and talk a little bit about the recent attacks on the 14th Amendment at the state level. So it's still early on in the legislative sessions, obviously, but it does look like the effort by a handful of state lawmakers to unveil and promote model legislation that would undermine the citizenship rights under the 14th Amendment hasn't really generated the momentum that they may have anticipated. For one, I think the legislative package is a little bit confusing. There are two elements of it, a model state bill and then a model state compact. I think the proponents of this legislation are going to be hard-pressed to really explain what their proposal actually does. The bill seems to try to manufacture a novel definition of state citizenship, which really contravenes the understanding and well-established principle of citizenship that the 14th Amendment brought and codified for our country almost 150 years ago now. And then the state compact really is a distinct piece of legislation that a state could pass. It would require at least more than one state to pass the compact and then would require authorization by Congress before it could take effect. The compact is a bit distinct from the bill in that it goes beyond just defining citizenship. It also does require the signatory states to deny standard birth certificates to a number of children born here in the United States to immigrant parents, not just undocumented immigrant parents, but a range of immigrants who either aren't citizens or do not possess permanent residency. With that, I mean, I think both pieces of legislation regardless of whether a state goes with the bill or with the state compact, either way, the legislation has to conform with the Constitution, and both these proposals are pretty apparent. It's pretty apparent that both proposals are unconstitutional. Second, I think I would just note that the proposal is really out of step with fundamental American values of fairness and equality that were codified by the 14th Amendment. In this country, we all start out equal before the law. Everyone born here is a citizen, with very discrete exceptions. And that applies to everyone regardless of who your parents are or what they did or whether today's politicians approve of them. And as John mentioned, I think this mean-spirited proposal really does knock us back to a time when the Supreme Court, in its now infamous Dred Scott decision that denied citizenship to African Americans born in this country, I think the result of that decision was, of course, that that the country would have a permanent racial subcast of children born here but denied the rights of citizenship. And the proposal does really seem to be extreme. And as John mentioned, even Republican colleagues of some of these legislators who promoted the bill are really walking away from this effort. We already know that even in a place like Arizona, passage of this measure, is not a foregone conclusion. Russell Pierce and John Kavanaugh are actually, they're two of the legislators who've endorsed this effort, are taking a lot of heat for diverting the legislature's attention away from pressing needs that the legislature actually has some control over, like coming up with a budget or stimulating job growth. And, of course, this criticism is coming from their own fellow Republican colleagues in the legislature. Lawmakers around the country really face similar economic challenges in their states, and Republican voices have joined droves of others who've really stood up in defense of the 14th Amendment. So you have conservative and liberal voices alike writing op-eds and speaking out against attacks on the Citizenship Clause. This may be a reason why we really haven't seen the model legislation actually introduced as a bill yet in any of the states, including the five states that were represented at the press conference a couple weeks ago. We have no doubt that it will surface somewhere, but as far as we know, nothing is moving yet, though we are seeing efforts to move other legislation targeting immigrants. I will also just note that in the realm of educational access, we've seen a number of states really take positive steps over the last several years in ensuring that public college tuition equality applies to all students who've attended and graduated from high school in their states, regardless of immigration status. 10 states now have these tuition equality laws on their books. A small handful are going the other way and attempting to pass legislation that would deny these young people admission to public college and university altogether. To date, South Carolina is the only state in the country that has such a ban on admission on the books, and that was through a law they enacted in 2008. But we do expect to see similar proposals in some of the neighboring states in the South, Georgia and North Carolina and possibly Alabama, based on efforts that their state university regents have taken in other contexts. There does seem to be some momentum for this type of legislation in those states, so we're certainly following that effort. Lastly, I'll just kind of close with a summary of where we are right now in terms of litigation against SB 1070-style copycats, which is, of course, the Arizona racial profiling law. On July 28, 2010, a federal court blocked core provisions of the law, including those that invite racial profiling or require individuals to show their papers upon demand by local police officers. The injunction blocked these and some other provisions from taking effect. There were a number of lawsuits filed against the law, including one by a civil rights coalition that included that includes the ACLU, the National Immigration Law Center, both of which are represented on this call, as well as MALDEF, the NAACP, and the Asian Pacific American Legal Center, among others. The court's injunction was granted on the lawsuit filed by the U.S. Government against the state of Arizona. Arizona has appealed, and the Ninth Circuit heard oral argument in November. We're awaiting a decision in that case, but we really think that this injunction is having a deterrent effect on other states considering such legislation, knowing that this unconstitutional proposal is likely to embroil them in costly litigation in their states. And I should also note that the Civil Rights Coalition lawsuit is still pending before the federal court. It has survived a motion to dismiss, and earlier this month, the coalition asked the same federal court to enjoin provisions related to the solicitation of work by day laborers that were not enjoined by the court on the preemption grounds argued by the Federal Department of Justice. Instead, we argue that the solicitation of work constitutes a form of free speech protected by the First Amendment, and so that should be enjoined as well. And with that, I will close.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, this is Michelle Waslin. Again, I'm the Senior Policy Analyst at the Immigration Policy Center, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the costs of these proposed bills in state legislatures. As we know, these battles are taking place during a time when states are facing severe budgetary problems, and many of these states are also considering serious budget cuts. Proponents of these state immigration bills would like you to believe that these measures are going to save their state a lot of money. Oftentimes, they cite statistics from national organizations about how much money unauthorized immigrants cost their state. But you have to look at these studies and these statistics with a great deal of caution. There are serious methodological problems with these studies, which we can discuss if you would like to. But generally, they fail to take into account the fiscal and economic benefits of immigrants and their children. To get the full story, you really have to remember that immigrants, and including undocumented immigrants, are workers, taxpayers, and consumers. And all of this helps to boost the productivity of the state and helps to support jobs. When you take away that population, it hurts your state economy. When people leave a state, that means lost tax revenue, lost workers, and lost consumers. And so far, very few states have really looked at what the overall cost of proposed legislation would be. Arizona, of course, everybody looks at SB 1070, and they did not attach a fiscal note to this proposal. A fiscal note is an analysis of the cost of the bill. So we don't really have a lot of information on the cost of SB 1070 in Arizona. However, a previous estimate of similar legislation looked at just the costs to one county, Yuma County. And it discovered that the cost would be up to $3 million for law enforcement, so the time and energy of the police, jails, and court costs. And then in addition to these direct costs, we know that Arizona's reputation and tourism industry has taken a hit. Arizona's Hotel and Lodging Association reported a combined loss of $15 million in lodging revenue due to meeting cancellations, and that was just after 4 months. According to a study by the Center for American Progress, the actual lost lodging revenue from these cancellations could top $45 million for the state of Arizona. Another state that has taken a crack at this is Kentucky, which is considering similar legislation. We know that there are about 50,000 undocumented immigrants in Kentucky. And according to a cost analysis done recently, the legislation there could cost Kentucky $90 million in court and prison costs, as well as foster care for the kids whose parents are jailed or deported. So this analysis looked and found that Kentucky could save up to $50 million in education costs for the children of unauthorized immigrants. But you have to remember, most of those children of unauthorized immigrants are U.S. citizens. So it's really not a cost of illegal immigration, but they are saying that they could save millions of dollars by not educating U.S. citizens. So the total cost, $90 million minus their, you know, quote-unquote savings of $50 million, would be a net cost of $40 million for the state of Kentucky. And this sum doesn't include additional police costs or lost revenue from the approximately two-thirds of illegal immigrants in the workforce, many of whom pay sales tax, income taxes. So your state may or may not do an official cost estimate of proposed legislation, but journalists and advocates can certainly do a cost estimate. And IPC has developed a checklist of things that need to be considered, need to be included when you're looking at the overall cost of proposed legislation. We have developed this checklist. It's available on our website, which is immigrationpolicy.org. And it's called Checklist for Estimating the Costs of SB 1070 Style Legislation. So just going through it quickly with you, a lot of these first sets of costs are the cost to police and jails and criminal justice costs because laws like SB 1070 either create new crimes that are being enforced or it means stepped up arrests for federal immigration laws. And it means that police are using their time to make these arrests. It means that more and more people end up in jails and all of the associated costs. So you have to, you know, project what would be the increase in arrests and what is the amount of time, the average number of hours that the police take to detain somebody for a particular offense, determine their legal status, transport them to a police station, book them, complete a report, prepare for court, and testify in court. These are all additional tasks that police would be taking on. And if you multiply that by the average cost per hour for police from their wages, then you can come up with that cost there. Costs in jails. You have to have a projected increase in the jail population and then figure out what would be the average number of days somebody would spend in jail for a particular offense. And then look at the average cost per day to jail somebody. And you can come up with an estimate of the jail costs for such a proposal. And then in addition to the police and the jails, of course, you have to look at the other part of the criminal justice system, public defender staff, jail space, courtrooms, and support offices needed to handle such an increased caseload. And then, as Kentucky pointed out, there is this cost of foster care and perhaps other benefit programs for children of detained immigrants. Many of those children, again, are going to be U.S. citizens, but regardless of their status, if their parents are detained or deported, the children need to be kept in some kind of care. And then, as I was explaining, we have to consider the cost to the state economy. What is the decrease in economic output, the decrease in tax revenue and consumer purchasing power as the state loses workers and taxpayers and consumers? And if that many undocumented immigrants and their families were to move out of the state or be deported. And you also have to look at legal immigrants and U.S. citizens who are family members with undocumented immigrants or who are simply leaving the state because of the environment in that state. You know, you add up all of those people who leave the state, and that would, again, be a decrease in the state's economy. And then, as Vic pointed out, there are the legal costs. None of these bills are going to go unchallenged. It could lead to years of costly litigation, and it's going to be the state taxpayers that need to pay to defend against the lawsuits that would ensue after such legislation would be passed. So please go to the checklist on the website, and we'd be happy to talk to you about estimating the costs of particular proposals. Now I am done, and I'm going to turn this over to our final speaker, and that's Suman Raghunathan from the Progressive States Network. Suman?
Thanks, Michelle, and we're really delighted to have folks on the call today. I'd like to add a part of the narrative. There's actually another part of the story here that isn't often told in the sort of mainstream coverage so far of state immigration policy. And in fact, you know, that's a reminder that not every state legislator is anti-immigrant. We have seen a Progressive States Network and work with a diverse and rapidly growing group of state legislators legislators who are actually known as state legislators for progressive immigration policy. This is a rapidly growing group whose numbers have more than doubled since Arizona passed its anti-immigrant bill early in 2010, and they include members from 32 states and counting. And so we've really seen a consistent number of progressive state legislators who understand the reality of immigrants and immigration in their communities and in their states, and have in fact long been consistently crafting common sense, practical solutions to immigration at the state level, ones that unite rather than divide communities, expand opportunity for all residents, keep communities safe, and uphold workers' rights and wage levels. And this is for all residents, both immigrants and the native-born. This action has, as John mentioned, only intensified, and this positive action has, in fact, only intensified as Washington, D.C. has failed to enact comprehensive immigration reform. And legislators are responding to calls for action from their constituents, but for positive, solution-oriented, and common-sense action on immigration at the state level. We've actually seen a groundswell of positive and practical legislation on immigration in several critical areas, and I wanted to provide those on the call today with a sense of several areas that we work on actively with progressive state legislators around state immigration policy. And these are areas that are already gaining traction and continue to move, and we estimate will only actually pick up speed as state legislatures continue to open their sessions this year in 2011. You know, it's worth noting that many of these progressive, practical solutions to immigration at the state level have often, or some have actually percolated or been first developed at the city level, cities like San Francisco, New York City, even New Haven, Connecticut, that have seen their numbers of immigrant residents swell over the past 10 to 15 years. And we've seen several progressive ideas for to really unite and bring together immigrant and native-born residents begin at the state at the city level and then continue to percolate up to the state level. They include tuition equity legislation, which allows undocumented students to afford a college education by being able to pay in-state tuition rates, and these proposals like tuition equity really foster immigrant integration and welcome immigrants into communities by supporting their avenues and options to learn English, take civics classes, and as in the case of tuition equity, get an affordable education at state universities and colleges. Most recently, Connecticut has introduced legislation or proposals to firstly grant in-state tuition to undocumented students to attend the state's colleges and universities, and secondly, to also extend an innovative state and city scholarship program to guarantee college education to all high school graduates who maintain a certain GPA and higher. Proposals along these lines would make sure that undocumented students who were high achievers were able to access the same programs and benefits as their or programs and a right to an education as their legal permanent resident and U.S. citizen classmates. Secondly, we are working actively, and there's been a groundswell of wage enforcement legislation and workers' rights legislation. These proposals defuse attacks against immigrant workers and, in fact, raise the wage floor by enforcing existing wage and hour laws, which apply to all workers, regardless of their immigration status. Wage enforcement and wage theft legislation have proven particularly attractive to state governments as they are currently seeking avenues to make their way out of and address state budget deficits. Many of these proposals actually go after bad apple exploitive employers who are seeking to not only pay their often immigrant workers a fair wage, but are often also bypassing their responsibilities to pay payroll taxes to state and local governments. So wage enforcement and workers' rights legislation has been particularly important and will continue to be, we believe, this year. We've also seen a groundswell of community policing legislation. These policies and proposals foster community trust in state and local law enforcement by barring police and law, and state troopers and state sheriffs from enforcing federal immigration laws and, in fact, racially profiling people based on their immigration status. We are also seeing a fair amount of interest in support for immigrant small business entrepreneurs. Immigrants are, in fact, 2 to 3 times as likely to open small businesses, thereby injecting much-needed tax revenue and really economic growth and revitalizing communities across the nation in both small and larger towns. And so many of these proposals would streamline the certification process to allow and to provide some support to immigrants to open small businesses and really serve as engines of economic growth. And finally, we have seen, some folks mentioned, pro-business and really broad approaches to immigration at the state level. Both Vic and John mentioned the Utah Compact, which we've already seen is ready and willing to be replicated in Nebraska. These are broad common sense approaches that unite often the faith-based community, business leaders, and state and local officials to really seek to respond to the reality of immigrants in their communities by crafting solutions-based proposals that really acknowledge the reality of immigrants in their community and want to bring them out of the shadows. With that, I'm going to sort of end allow some time for question and answers. Thanks.
Great.
I was just going to say
I wanted to thank all of our speakers. That's a lot of great information. And then, Mark, I was going to ask you to give us the instructions for asking questions.
Yes, ma'am. If you wish to ask a question, please press star and one on your phone. That is star and one. And you may remove yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. And we will allow just a moment for questions to queue.
I'd also like to remind people that if for some reason your question doesn't get answered on today's call, or if you want to speak to any of today's speakers at length, you can certainly get in touch with them through us. You should call Wendy Sefsaf, who is our communications manager, and she is at 202-507-7524.
And all right, we will go now to the side of Jeremy Redman with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for doing this. I've got a couple questions. First is, I cover this issue pretty closely here in our legislature, and no bills have been introduced relating to Arizona's, but I don't want to miss anything. What do you know about what Georgia's legislature is working on, what may be introduced? If you can offer specifics, that would be helpful. And then secondly, to what extent is FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, or its legal arm, the Institute for Reform Law, Immigration Law, involved in advising these legislatures in Georgia or other states on doing this type of legislation?
Excellent question. Who would like to take that one?
This is Vivek Malhotra with the American Civil Liberties Union. I can take the second question and just talk briefly. FAIR has a legal arm, the Immigration Reform Law Institute, which has been very closely involved in developing and promoting some of the model legislation, which has been replicated around the country, specifically SB 1070. Was authored in part by FAIR's legal counsel, Chris Kobach, who is a politician in Kansas and also formerly a constitutional law professor. Recently in Washington, D.C., when a group of state lawmakers came together to unveil the legislation to undermine the 14th Amendment, Chris Kobach and Michael Heffman, who is the general counsel at the Immigration Reform Law Institute, were by their side. And so there is a very, very close relationship. If you look at the legislation that is introduced around the country, we're not really talking about innovative proposals. They're really, in many ways, just copycats of each other, down to the same grammatical errors or spelling errors. So there really is a coordinated effort to kind of promote the legislation around the country. So I would say that it is a very close relationship.
And it's John Blazer with the National Immigration Law Center. As to the first part of the question, I mean, we're aware of efforts in the state to try to enact a 1070 copycat bill. I think the politics there are interesting because the Georgia Farm Bureau came out strongly against a 1070 copycat because of its recognition of the severe labor shortage in the agricultural industry that would be exacerbated by 1070 copycat or other measures that seek to push immigrants out. You know, some estimates have found that approximately 200,000 Latinos left the state of Arizona in the wake of 1070, and that really gives pause to states that need immigrant labor and don't think the solution to the problem is always to push people out and deter people from coming, but rather to try to figure out constructively which individuals are necessary in the state for the economy and how to better integrate them. And as Suman mentioned, how to make sure that they're paying taxes, working on the books, and the employers are paying into unemployment, workers' comp, and other Social Security and other taxes on behalf of those workers. The other thing in Georgia that's interesting is, again, as with birthright citizenship, we see a pushing of the envelope that really defies most public policy sensibility if it is thought of apart from pure chest beating around immigrant bashing. I mean, Georgia is one of the states that seems intent to deny undocumented students from enrolling and participating in state higher education institutions, even if they are fully qualified and even if they're paying their full way. It was, you know, a couple of years ago, you know, more of a debate as to whether or not such individuals should be eligible for in-state tuition, and there are debates happening across the states. But as with birthright citizenship, we're seeing, you know, I think the restrictionists trying to measure just how far they can push things in ways that start to defy reason if the rationale is what's good for the economy and what's good for the state.
Thanks. Suman, did you have anything to add to that about Georgia?
I would just say that Georgia, you know, I'd like to remind folks that there are actually progressive state legislators in Georgia who are in the process and who are working with us to introduce some wage enforcement legislation. Obviously, as John mentioned, the Georgia Farm Bureau's decision to come out against SB 1070 has provided some welcome fuel to an effort to uphold workers' rights in an agricultural state like Georgia, and to really make sure that on the positive end that businesses are being held accountable for responsible practices and for also ensuring that immigrant and native-born workers are really able to take advantage of the existing labor protections and wage enforcement protections that are available and should be available to them regardless of their immigration status. So I would just flag that some progressive state legislators in Georgia are working hard on making sure that workers are able to get a fair day's work and get paid for it.
Great. Thank you. I understand we have a few more questions in line. I just want to say I don't think that we'll be able to go through, or we will not be able to go through, each state in detail. I think that you got a lot of good general information by the answer to the Georgia question. But if you have specific questions about your state, perhaps you could hold those and get in touch with us separately after today's call. So, Mark, do you want to go ahead with the next question?
Certainly. We will go next to the side of Sranko Sui Yuan with Tyler Media. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
I just heard the actual question from I actually listened to the question from Michelle, but, you know, I was just wondering if there's any talks of a copycat bill of the SB 1070 in regards in the state of Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, quickly. Yes, I believe that they are considering SB 1070 legislation there. I don't know if anybody has a quick response, any more specifics on Oklahoma and what's happening there?
This is Vic Milhotra with the ACLU. Not aware of a specific bill, but Representative Randy Terrell, who's well known for kind of introducing anti-immigrant bills, has talked about bringing an SB 1070 copycat to the state.
This is Simone. I just want to add, you know, we've seen in many different states that simply because a state legislator announces their intent to either introduce an anti-immigrant piece of legislation based on Arizona's SB 1070, we've seen several different states, you know, ranging from Rhode Island to Nevada to several other states last year as well, where efforts to introduce copycat legislation simply just did not have the fuel that they needed to make their way through often committees and state legislatures, let alone through the actual legislative process. So it's important for people to remember and realize that, you know, there is a fair amount of political capital that is necessary to enact and pass anti-immigrant legislation, and that is not in evidence in states across the board.
That's a really good point. We know that thousands of pieces of legislation are introduced every single year in state legislatures. Many have to do with immigration, but very few of them ever see the light of day. So we have to keep that in mind as well. Mark, do we have another question?
Yes, we do. And as a reminder, if you wish to ask a question, please press star and one on your phone. We will go next to the side of Johannes Rosello with Mundo Hispanico. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
I would like to know if you have information as you discuss the cost that an SB 1070 will cost to Kentucky. Do you have information like that for the state of Georgia?
That's a good question. No, we have not done the estimates for every single state. What IPC has done is created a worksheet with all of the relevant things that need to be taken into consideration so that interested parties within the state can use that worksheet to develop a cost estimate for your legislation there. It might also be worthwhile to ask the person who's sponsoring the legislation or other people within your state legislature whether or not they plan to do a cost analysis of the proposal and really urge people to do a cost analysis, because I think that, again, in light of the budgetary restrictions that all of these states are going through right now, knowing that this could be incredibly expensive for the state is an important factor that needs to be taken into account.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark?
And we will go next to the side of Justine Sharrock with New America Media. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yeah, thank you for this. Quickly, I was just wondering, in terms of the wage enforcement and workers' rights legislation, if there is a really strong example to look at that people who are doing it properly.
Great question. Suman?
Yeah. So there are several different people who have done it well. New York State has done an excellent job with broad wage enforcement legislation. New York State at the end of last year also passed passed a wage theft bill, which addresses the phenomenon I was talking about where employers are essentially misclassifying workers often as independent contractors to avoid paying payroll taxes to state and local governments. I'd like to also add that New York State has last year passed an excellent domestic workers' bill of rights to guarantee basic labor protections and some wage guarantees or wage levels for domestic workers who are often totally ignored and often exempted from basic worker protections. Washington State has also done some really good legislation, and Illinois has as well.
Thank you.
Great.
And as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star and one. That is star and one. And we will take a follow-up now from the side of Jeremy Redman with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Please go ahead.
I thought maybe you mentioned this earlier, or maybe I missed it. It's an update on the status of the Chamber of Commerce versus Whiting before the Supreme Court on Arizona's law regarding e-verify.
Right. So this is a different Arizona law. It preceded SB 1070 by a couple of years. But in essence, what Arizona did was enacted an employer sanctions law that included a mandate that virtually all employers in the state, private and public, use the flawed electronic verification program, E-Verify, which is a voluntary program that was set up by the United States United States government to really evaluate whether the program was worth using for employment verification purposes. Because Arizona decided to kind of take things into their own hands and just mandate it under state law, although it was not mandated by federal law, it was very vulnerable to legal challenge, and a number of groups brought a legal challenge, in addition to the Chamber of Commerce, the ACLU, and National Immigration Law Center are actually part of that litigation. It has worked its way up to the United States Supreme Court. An oral argument was held before the court in early December. So we do expect a decision by the United States Supreme Court on mandatory electronic verification and employer sanctions laws by the state. And obviously that will have a broad impact across the country, because we do have over 20 states have enacted some form of employer sanctions law at the state level. They do vary somewhat, but a number of them also do seek to mandate E-Verify in some form.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mark, do we have anybody else lined up with questions?
Yes, we do. We will go now to the side of Richard Springer with India West Newspaper. Please go ahead.
Yes. Didn't the Mississippi State Senate pass a bill this week that would allow law enforcement officers to check a person's immigration status during a traffic stop? And will there any action taken to protest that or to go to court against that?
Great question. Who has an update on Mississippi?
Well, it was just yesterday that one of the state legislative committees considered that bill again. I think it was notable and quite distressing to a lot of people within the state that a decision was made to hold that vote on the Martin Luther King holiday. Not yesterday, but the day before yesterday, a day that traditionally African-American legislators sit out in observation of the holiday. As to the question of lawsuits, I mean, I think a court, you know, enjoined the court provisions of 1070 to the extent that states are going to thumb their nose at that court's decision and choose to, you know, reenact those core provisions, they're going to be met with legal scrutiny from people in the state and, you know, partners outside the state who are going to be taking a look at the possibility of litigating those cases. Unfortunate the need to relitigate over and over again and court by court, but groups such as ours, the National Immigration Law Center, and other groups on this call and groups not on this call, like the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, take these bills very seriously, and we'll be looking at them closely with the possibility of litigation under consideration.
Great. More questions?
And as a reminder, if you wish to ask a question, please press star and one. That is star and one. And we'll wait just a moment to see if we have any more queue up.
Well, that gives me a chance to remind you again, if you would like to speak to any of today's speakers at length, you can contact Wendy Safsaf here at IPC, and she'll put you in touch with them. Her number is 202-507-7524.
And we have now a follow-up from Johannes Rosello with Mundo Hispanica. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
My question was exactly that, to have the telephone number to contact you. I don't have it complete. It's 201-507.
202-507-7524.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. No more questions in the queue, Mark?
We have one, looks like our final question, come from Margie Gonzalez with the Idaho Commission on Hispanic Affairs. Please go ahead.
Hi, we're just wondering if you have any information about what's going to happen in the legislature in Idaho, in the entire state.
Quickly, does anybody have information about Idaho?
Could you repeat the question?
We are wondering, because we've heard of some legislation that's going to be written, but we haven't really gotten a lot of information as to what's going to happen with that, with the legislation that they're planning on writing, and it sounds like a copycat of Arizona.
Yeah, I've heard murmurs of a copycat legislation proposal, legislative proposal in Idaho, though like you and like many of the you know, anti-immigrant proposals that have attempted to cascade in the past several months, I have not as yet seen model legislation or nor have I seen you know, specifics or details.
Idaho was amongst the states that the state legislators for legal immigration touted as a state that would introduce a state law challenging the interpretation of the 14th Amendment. But as people have discussed on this call, we've yet to see those threats materialize in actual states, and we anticipate that it's possible that fewer numbers of states will choose to go that route due to the reaction that they're receiving with their ideas. But we'll have to wait and see as regards to particular states like Idaho that had been queued up.
And this is Vic Malhotra with the ACLU. I would just underscore the point that, you know, we fully expect SB 1070 copycats and some of these other forms of legislation to be introduced in, you know, many, many states across the country, just like the thousands of other bills that are introduced relating to immigrants across the country. Just a fraction of them are actually going to be able to go through the process, the full legislative process, and become law. So I think, you know, all of us need to be just mindful of the fact that this that introduction of the legislation does not mean that it will be viable. And there are so many factors that the states are facing, particularly in solving really grave economic problems that they're facing, you know, trying to balance budgets, stimulating job growth, that we really think that in many states some of these bills are just going to be a distraction from those things that the legislators actually have control over.
Well, thanks. I think that's a really great note to end on. So with that, I want to once again thank all of our speakers for all of the fabulous information that you provided us. Thank you, everybody, for joining this call. Please look for more information at immigrationpolicy.org, and we will continue to have telephonic briefings such as this one to keep you updated and to answer your questions. So thank you, Mark, and thank you, everyone.